I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the hurts in the home and what we can do about them. The Domestic Violence Network has unveiled an ambitious new 3-year plan to end domestic violence. We're going to explore the plan and the problem that produced it. My guests are Chris Hanberg, Director of Programs and Research for the Domestic Violence Network, Alan Witchie, Executive Director of the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention of Greater Indianapolis Incorporated, and Jessica Fraser, Director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families. To join the conversation, call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about an ambitious new 3-year plan from the Domestic Violence Network to combat and perhaps eliminate domestic violence. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Chris Hanberg, he's Director of Programs and Research for the Domestic Violence Network, Alan Witchie, who is Executive Director for the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention of Greater Indianapolis Incorporated. I told you, Alan, I wasn't going to get through that in one breath. Jessica Fraser, who is Director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families. Good to have all of you here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So let's start first. I think what we need to do is talk about the plan, and then we probably need to talk about the larger problem. So, Chris, I'm gonna start with you on this. Tell me, you know, give me the elevator speech, really, about what we're doing here.
Sure. First, thanks for having us here.
Oh, certainly. It's our pleasure.
Very nice to be able to talk about this. So this is a community-wide plan focused on looking at the intersection between domestic violence and several social issues over the course of 3 years. So every 6 months, we'll look at a different issue and how it intersects with domestic violence, with the goal of educating the community, educating service providers, and then bringing together folks that work on domestic violence and, for example, Alan and Jessica, who work on economic issues, bringing those folks together, learning from each other so that we could better serve the community.
So, and what are the 6 areas that we're talking about here?
Sure. Education. We're going to focus first on economics. Then we're going to go to childhood experiences. We'll look at mental health, substance abuse, and suicide. And what we did, we held focus groups, online surveys. We had individual conversations with folks for about a year. And we analyzed the data, and a pattern kept emerging to look at the risk and protective factors associated with domestic violence and better understand those, because a lot of times, most of the time, people who experience domestic violence, they don't just experience domestic violence. They might have financial issues. They might have undiagnosed mental health issues. They might have substance abuse issues. And so to treat domestic violence just as its own issue without addressing those other parts of their life can be an exercise in futility.
Alan and Jessica, talk to me a little bit about how you and your organizations got involved and what the process was for deciding that you wanted to buy into dealing with this. Because it is a slight shift of focus for you. Jessica,
sure.
Alan pointed at you, so I'm assuming
going
that means you. Yeah.
So at the Indiana Institute for Working Families, we are concerned about low-income families achieving and maintaining economic self-sufficiency. And as we started looking at that, we started thinking a lot about what self-sufficiency is. And that led us to reaching out to service providers to kind of talk to them about self-sufficiency and how to help families get there. And through those conversations with the folks that are providing direct service, we started getting put in touch more and more with domestic violence providers. And we were hearing their stories and hearing how much there are these intersections, great title of the community-wide plan, between societal factors, societal determinants like wage, employment status, the type of job you have, housing, security, and domestic violence. And so we have trained several of Indy's domestic violence shelters on our self-sufficiency standard to try to help folks get access to a more financially stable sort of home life. And we're happy to help DVN on exploring kind of the bigger picture of this. How do we scale that out to the systemic changes that need to happen?
Alan.
Great. Well, first of all, I'll shorten our name, the Coalition for Homelessness
it's
Intervention.
Chip. We're going to go Chip.
Right?
Chip. Yeah,
so we're
going to
go with Chip. And, you know, for us, it was really a critical issue. It has been ever since we've been around. There are some really key factors that can lead to homelessness in our community, and domestic violence is one of them. So we know the work that we do, there's this intersection clearly with domestic violence on a regular basis, because this is what leads to homelessness frequently in our community. So sometimes people are fleeing a dangerous situation, and they don't have anywhere to go. They don't have any support or other resources or other options. And so fleeing domestic violence is what leads to their homelessness. So for us, it made a lot of sense. And we look at homelessness in Indianapolis. Chip, we track a lot of the collective data that is done, so we know in our community whether we're doing a good job in addressing homelessness or ending homelessness. And when we looked at it, it's really pretty extraordinary. When you look at the domestic violence, we know that at least one out of three people who experience homelessness in Indianapolis say that they have experienced domestic violence. So that's very compelling for us to be at the table in this plan and saying we need to be part of a solution.
We are talking about domestic violence here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So, you know, in some ways, this is part of a new approach to dealing with social problems that, you know, in many ways, what we're talking about here is a holistic approach. Instead of taking a look at one problem in isolation, we're trying to figure out the ways they interconnect and deal with the whole thing. How much of this, and I want to hear everybody's thoughts on this, is a product of the fact that attempting to attack these problems in isolation either hasn't been particularly effective, or at the very best case scenario, we've hit a ceiling. You know, that there's only so much we can do unless we start doing these other things. I'm going to start with Jessica on that.
Sure. I think at the Institute, we have long felt that you can't solve the problem of poverty in isolation, and that certainly, you know, seems to be the case with domestic violence as well. We see that educational attainment level is going to impact your income. It's going to impact your work status. That's going to impact the educational attainment of your children. Studies show it's going to impact your housing security and that stability. It causes, you know, emotional pressures on the household. So all of these things are connected, and if we don't start treating them the way like they're connected, one solution that might help this one piece of it doesn't solve any of the other problems that are impacting on top of it as well. So we have to take a step back and look more holistically.
Alan.
Yeah, I think that if we're going to solve any problems, we have to look broader than the issue we're striving to solve, right? So homelessness in itself is not the issue. The issue is homelessness and domestic violence, or homelessness and veterans, or homelessness and runaway youth, or homelessness and mental health issues and addiction. So from our perspective, it really is critical that we have sort of this collective approach to how we address the issue. We can't have impact on solving homelessness unless we're addressing domestic violence. Because if domestic violence isn't resolved or solved or reduced in our community, that the inflow of people who experience homelessness from domestic violence will never stop. So it's critical for us. This is an issue that's really important I was saying earlier, one in three people we know experience domestic violence. They report. That's sort of the self-report, right? So we think that that number is probably a lot higher because that's just sort of the self-report. But we know that a third of those people experience domestic violence within 3 months of their homelessness. And over half of them experienced it within 1 year of their homelessness. So domestic violence, we think, is a direct cause that leads frequently to homelessness, and the data supports that. So we have to address it. But sometimes that issue also connects to an addiction issue or a mental health issue. And so sometimes we have six or seven issues at the table when we're dealing with homelessness, and this is just one of the really important ones.
Chris.
You know, I think that it's interesting as we're talking, because it's not like someone is sitting around their house saying, I've got substance abuse issues and mental health issues, and which one will I deal with now? It's more of what is the most
pressing. Yeah, my life is out of control.
My life is out of control. It's yeah. more of trying to keep things, you know, as stable as possible, and then almost like a whack-a-mole game where you solve one problem and then another one pops up.
That's right.
And so connecting service providers together so that someone who's experiencing housing issues or financial issues and domestic violence, those advocates or service providers they're working with, they can work together. And so one of the programs that we're doing is with the Indianapolis Housing Agency, where we're going to bring together their case managers and property managers with advocates in the community and provide a time to network so that if somebody is a property manager and one of their residents is experiencing violence, they know exactly who they can call at an agency, not just blanket call the Julian Center or call Families First, but I can call Mary Alice at the Julian Center. I can call Jenny White at Coburn Place and they can help me out.
Can I add one more thing
please.
To this conversation, too?
Sure.
I think it's also important because at the policy level, if we design policy that sort of is honed in on one solution and then it's not as successful as we would like because it hasn't addressed all of these other issues, then what we can run into is they'll say, oh, well, that didn't work, so we should just abandon it. Well, no, that was the right direction. We just didn't put all of the pieces together.
And I do think, just to add to that, that we have to think more systemically as a community. Frequently, we want to address, especially I think nonprofits that might be addressing one specific issue might say, hey, this is our issue. Is it domestic violence? Is it HIV/AIDS? Is it education? Well, the truth is so many of these issues are strung together. And so we have to think systemically, both in terms of, as you were saying, about policies and procedures, but also about services, about how people provide services together and collectively and connect versus we just provide services to people who come in our doors. But better, like, how do we provide services as a community?
So, Chris, how is this going to roll out? I mean, when you talk about the six areas, you know, what are we going to see in this first 6 months then?
So actually, for the first event that we're doing, it's in partnership with CHIP. We'll be hosting a community education panel discussion on the current state of housing, domestic violence, and barriers to seeking services in the city. And that'll be at CHIP on February 28th from 3 to 4:30. And we have several panelists from different fields who will just go through, where are we at in housing? There's been a lot of changes in the last year that Alan is better equipped to speak to. But really want to provide a dialogue about where we're at so that service providers know how to navigate. So that's our first event. In March, we'll be doing the training that I mentioned at the Indianapolis Housing Agency, and that's primarily for advocates. And then Jessica from Institute and then Zach from CHIP, we're working on something for the summer. One more thing I want to note is we're
sure.
not just looking at people who are in low-income brackets, and this is probably a little too much to get into, but we also want
to... Well, we got an hour, so
yeah.
don't worry. We got time. We'll get to it, yeah.
But we also want to look at what does domestic violence look like in affluent communities? You know, mm-hmm. in Hamilton County, where people make a little bit more money, domestic violence happens there at the same rates that it does in Marion County. And so we want to work with Prevail, who's up in Hamilton County, to talk about and engage with the community how we address it in an area where people might have the attitude that it doesn't happen here.
So the kickoff, the next event, though, is this thing in
right.
February 28th. And it's at CHIP. Mm-hmm. Probably ought to tell people where CHIP is here. Alan.
Sure.
That's your view.
We are at 1100 West 42nd Street. We're in the Indiana Interchurch Center.
Okay. And will there be a cost for this if people want to attend?
Is absolutely not. The only thing we do is we ask that you register. You can go online to dvnconnect.org, and you can sign up for our newsletter. We'll be sending out information about that tomorrow, and the invitation will be live tomorrow morning.
We are talking about domestic violence and the Domestic Violence Network's ambitious new three-year plan to combat domestic violence. My guests are Chris Hanberg of the Domestic Violence Network, Alan Witchie of CHIP, and Jessica Fraser, who is with the Indiana Institute for Working Families. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email, nolimits@wfyi.org, or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about domestic violence and the Domestic Violence Network's ambitious new three-year plan with some community partners to combat domestic violence and perhaps eliminate it, if not eliminate, greatly reduce it. My guests are Chris Hanberg. He's director of programs and research for the Domestic Violence Network. Alan Witchie, who is Executive Director for the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention of Greater Indianapolis Incorporated, otherwise known as CHIP, and Jessica Fraser, who is Director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families. So I'm going to ask kind of a complicated question here, but I think it's one of the things that I've thought about, since a lot of the focus, it sounds like, of this new initiative is to educate people, to make them aware of their options and ways that they can deal with this, and we will get to those ways. But what are going to be the signposts for success here? The knowledge this is working, because my follow-up, I'll give you it ahead of time, is really going to be, how are you going to know that the numbers really reflect success? Because I remember 25 years or so ago when, you know, there was, for example, a lot of focus because of the Mike Tyson trial and the William Kennedy Smith trials on the issue of rape and sexual assault. There was a lot of community attention, and it turned out, in fact, that the reported numbers went up. Part of that mm-hmm. was because more people were aware that they could report at that point, but it made it a lot harder to track, okay, is what we're doing working here? Is it going to be effective? I'll start with Alan on that one, but I want to hear everyone's thoughts.
Well, you know, for us, success is a little bit easier to measure because our goal is to get people housed and make sure that they have the services they need, the wraparound services to stay housed. So I would hope that the way that we measure success related to homelessness and housing is looking at how many people are entering the homeless network that experience or report domestic violence, and how many of those people we're able to house, and whether or not we're able to reduce that number over time.
Chris.
You know, I think that you touched on it, that for me, I look at number of people who are reporting. And it's not that domestic violence is going up. It's that people are finally seeking services when before maybe they didn't feel like they could or they weren't aware of the services. So when the numbers go up, for me, that is a sad success story because people are being aware of the services that are available. I also think that for me, a success looks like increased collaboration between agencies who serve different populations. So people that work in the mental health field, people that work in substance abuse or homelessness, when they start collaborating with agencies and entities that work on sexual assault and domestic violence, building MOUs, having collaborative events and strategic partnerships, for me, that is a real success.
And for those of us who do not speak bureaucraties. MOU is Memorandum of Understanding.
Memorandum of Understanding is almost like a non-binding contract between agencies. It's an understanding. So, you know, sort of like in The Godfather when the families merge.
Yeah. Not sure that's necessarily the context.
Not exactly the context, but certainly does work.
Jessica.
So our sort of vantage point is 30,000 foot view. So it's a kind of one more step removed from the direct service providers. But we really look at, is median income going up? Is there enrollment for low-income, low-skill adults in higher education? Is that going up? You know, do we see adult education is happening? Do we see jobs that are providing paid family leave and paid sick leave and higher wages? Those are the sorts of things that we look at. And we believe that those things will positively impact, you know, the sort of the situation with domestic violence. It'll make things better. But we don't look at domestic violence statistics specifically. We rely on Chris for that. He tells us what's going on.
We are talking about domestic violence here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. We've got an email from a listener named Randall who says, please discuss female-on-male violence, both physical and psychological. Chris, I'll throw that one to you, I think.
Sure. I think that there's a common perception that, you know, only women experience domestic violence. And, you know, if a man experiences domestic violence, they're probably in a same-sex relationship. But statistically, 1 in 7 men will experience domestic violence. And that's from an Avon Foundation study. I think that's a little low. What I've seen, I spent 10 years at the Julian Center and IMPD working on domestic violence issues, actually going to the scene as violence occurred, is that men experience a lot of emotional and some physical violence. And so a lot of shaming, a lot of humiliation, a lot of put-downs that keep their self-esteem, leave their self-esteem pretty destroyed. So it is common and something that's not often talked about.
Well,
I could add to that in the homeless system, what statistics we do have, and again, you know, we don't always know that because it is self-reported that these statistics are, you know, accurate. We think they're low, but we know that at least, you know, 1 out of 4 people that become homeless and report that they have domestic violence are men. So we don't know. We don't always know if that is, again, male on male violence or female on male violence, but we know that a percentage of that is female on male violence. It does happen, and it does lead to homelessness. It does lead to other things. And so it's important, I think, as we talk about this plan, is how do we sort of dissect these biases or stereotypes in the system as well to say, you know, it isn't always female. It isn't always women with children. And we have to be able to accommodate that. And that's, like, really great. For instance, the Julian Center is a shelter locally that does a wonderful job of accommodating men who have to escape domestic violence situations when that comes up.
We are talking about domestic violence here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Melissa has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Thank you. And I just want to hail you and your guests for what you do in providing the platform and all the people that help you. Just on a personal note, I had the privilege of staying at the Julian Center before it's at its current location beforehand. I'm a college-educated person, and I can testify that it hits everyone, all levels. That said, I want to ask, given that the federal government is possibly cutting the grants for domestic violence, they're looking at it strongly, what is local legislation that we can be supporting here currently at our Capitol?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Melissa. I'll throw that one first to Chris.
Well, thank you for your call, and And thank you for bringing light to that issue. With legislative opportunities, I think Jessica is more sort of in that field. So is there –
Jessica's looking panicked at the moment. Well,
let me say, I'm not sure, and forgive me for being ignorant on this. I'm not sure there's any legislation that directly – states domestic violence, but there's certainly legislation that impacts the economics and the housing of people who experience domestic violence. So with that, I would ask Jessica to talk about some of the bills going on. We were talking earlier about one in particular.
Yeah, let me just address Melissa's specific question, just throw a resource out to her. I know, because I know this person personally, that the person who is at the State House for the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence, does a great job in lobbying for domestic violence. And so going to the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence's website might be the best place to go to look for specific domestic violence legislation.
What's the URL there?
I don't know off the top of my head. We'll get it for you.
Okay.
I
might add,
we
will also post all of this on our Facebook page for our listeners. So
while Chris is rapidly Googling, you guys Google Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence.
Yes.
But, you know, back to the social determinants, there are things that the state can do to sort of make families more financially stable. And so we're at the Institute looking at a bill that that makes it easier to get nutrition assistance. You know, if you're having to escape a violent situation, being able to quickly and easily access nutrition assistance could be very important. The bill specifically takes away the asset test, which requires a lot of paperwork. If you're trying to flee a domestic violence situation and you need to sign up for the nutrition assistance program, you might not have the ability to go around to your bank account that you share with your intimate partner and get all of this information that you need to get on the nutrition assistance program. So that's sort of a connection point. There's a bill posted that expands payday lending, and that's something we're very concerned with because it has really negative effects for families. So there are things going on that connect, but I don't know anything about specific.
And if I could, there's a bill that has been introduced both in the House and the Senate called the Housing First legislation, and that is something that would be really great to advocate for because it would, for the first time, create some funding from a state level that would allow both for rental subsidy and emergency housing that could be used to help people who are facing domestic violence. So right now, because we do a lot of advocacy work both locally and at the state level, and CHIP employs some lobbyists as well to help us with this work, we really are encouraging people that are interested in domestic violence to look at those two bills because that is the best opportunity to bring actual resources to the table to help with domestic violence.
Chris.
So first, I would say the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence's website is icadvinc.org, and that'll be on your Facebook page. Going back to the VAWA funding, and it's been all over social media that, you know, there's been a threat that the Violence Against Women Act would be eliminated. That would have a devastating effect to local shelters, to community partners that work in domestic violence, and more importantly, to Hoosiers all over the state. I mean, there's a lot of organizations that rely on that funding so that people can safely exit a relationship. And for me, that's the biggest point, is that if you know someone who's experiencing violence, it's really easy to say, why don't you just kick them out, or why don't you just move, or why don't you just change the locks? But that's one of the worst things we can say to somebody, because that's when it becomes very, very dangerous. And not everybody has the money to just drop and leave everything they own, sign a new lease, get new furniture. I mean, we're talking thousands of dollars just for that. So for me, the shelters provide a critical service as a stopgap between someone's abusive relationship and having the ability to thrive.
We are talking about domestic violence here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Track us down on Twitter @WFYI. Find us on Facebook @NoLimitsWFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Kenny has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kenny, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm delighted to hear the kinds of services that your guests provide. Those are obviously really critical for low income people. But to leave the impression that domestic violence is a problem, that's so you're sort of leaving the impression that it's confined to the low income people. I'm really struck by the number of men who have been nominated to positions in the Trump administration who have domestic violence in their backgrounds, including Trump himself, and who have, you know, made settlements, of course, financial settlements, so that these things are swept to the side. But if you leave this, you know, leave the impression that this is a problem of low-income people rather than a problem of a culture, that we live in a culture that in which violence against women is sanctioned, and, you know, either directly or indirect violence. When you tell them what to do with their bodies in regards to health care, that's this type of violence against control against women. And it, the ultimate expression, of course, is physical violence. So, I mean, that's the issue. And I'm not hearing you really address that. I'm hearing you, kind of repeat this myth that, the domestic violence is a problem of low income, rather than male attitudes or even female attitudes, that it's okay.
Thanks very much for the call, Kenny. To be fair, they have said a couple of times it cuts across all sorts of demographic boundaries and barriers, but we will explore it. You anticipated my next line of questioning, mm-hmm. So I thank you very much for the call.
Sure.
So, and I think this is an important point, even though, you know, I want to make clear you guys have dealt with this, although we've alluded to it, not really dealt with it in depth. How much of the struggle here is the popular perception that domestic violence is, you know, Marlon Brando in a singlet, getting ready to beat up Vivian Leigh, mm-hmm. And it's in something just above tenement quality housing and all of that, that's what it's confined to, and we don't have to worry about it as long as it is relegated to that kind of sphere. Chris, I'll start with you.
Well, first of all, I would say to the caller, yes, you are absolutely correct that the larger issue is a culture that does not value or treat women equally. It is not just a quote-unquote poor problem. It exists in all communities, but data tends to skew to those in poverty because the data relies on self-reporting or data from the police department, which people that live in, you know, more confined spaces can call the police more or tend to call the police more for those kind of issues. Domestic violence in affluent communities looks a lot different. I've worked with clients that lived in, you know, million-dollar homes but had no access to money except that which they were given by their abusive partner. And so I completely agree that it is about the attitudes in our culture that if a husband beats up his wife, then maybe she did something to cause that, which is an absolute myth. People who live in an affluence may not have the resources either to go out and do the things we were talking about. It's very interesting the amount of people who are living in functional poverty in wealthy communities because they don't have access to the funds that they might even be earning.
So we probably ought to define what we mean also by domestic violence.
Sure.
And Chris, I'll stay with you on that one.
Sure. We look at domestic violence as intimidation, assault, emotional abuse, verbal abuse, financial abuse, technological abuse, and sexual abuse and physical abuse. Usually people just think of, you know, physical abuse as domestic violence, but there's a lot of steps that come before someone is physically assaulted. There's a lot of control that's exerted, a lot of jealousy, a lot of emotional abuse.
And if I could just add to that, I think a lot of people don't leave because they don't have a place to go. So their choice is, do I become homeless or do I stay in an abusive situation? And we see that very frequently. 80% of the people who become homeless in this city every year are homeless for the very first time. And they do. I mean, like, economics don't impact whether you're homeless or not. You know, there's a lot of misconceptions about who's homeless. It's not the average person isn't the person staying on the street corner with a sign. Most people become homeless through some kind of catastrophic issue, and they bounce back.
We are talking about domestic violence here on No Limits. My guests are Chris Hanberg of the Domestic Violence Network, Alan Witchie, who is with CHIP, and Jessica Fraser, who is with the Indiana Institute for Working Families. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about domestic violence and the Domestic Violence Network's ambitious new three-year plan that they're doing in cooperation with some community partners. My guests are Chris Hanberg, he's director of programs and research for the Domestic Violence Network, Alan Witchie, who is executive director of the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention of Greater Indianapolis Incorporated, otherwise known as CHIP, and Jessica Fraser, who is director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families. We've got a Facebook comment, really, from a listener named Sandy. And if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Sandy writes, "Kudos to all who do this critical work and support the most vulnerable in our society. We have a society and current administrations that minimize violence against women as men just talking. Then this happens," and Sandy's listed an article from New York Magazine, which is now linked to our Facebook page, and people can follow there. And picks up, says, "Team Trump's overall budget plan is reportedly modeled on a blueprint from the right-wing Heritage Foundation, which calls the VAMA grants a misuse of federal resources and a distraction from concerns that are truly the province of the federal government." Chris, you're looking thoughtful and pensive. Probably ought to explain to people what VAMA is, too. VAMA.
The Violence Against Women Act? Yeah.
Well, it says VAMA. So
I think she means the Violence Against Women Act.
Okay.
So the Violence Against Women Act is, I believe, 25 years old, and it sets aside funding specific to address domestic violence in the community. And they give a lot of grants out, which shelters rely on, to not only help those that are in emergency needs, but also to educate the community on domestic violence. And I think you're right. As a culture, we've seen a shift. So let's think real quick about Bill Cosby. When all of those allegations came forward that he sexually assaulted multiple people over years, as a culture, there was a backlash where, no, we will no longer give you awards. We'll take down your statues. We're not going to buy your DVDs and watch the Cosby Show and pretend like it didn't happen. So as a culture, we made a decision that in this instance, sexual assault is unacceptable and we are no longer going to support you in anything you do. We have yet to do that with someone who commits acts of domestic violence. And I would say, and I don't want to get too political because we're a nonpartisan organization, but we did the same thing with Trump. You know, we heard him say, in this audio recording, that he sexually assaulted women, and we did not decide collectively that that was a disqualifier to be president. And so I think that says a lot of where we're at as a culture, that that can be dismissed, it can be justified, it can be, that was just locker talk, and then we can move on from it. And so that, to me, is kind of the thinking, that the violence against women is secondary or it's a back burner issue.
Well, let me ask this then, because we can chase the larger question of Donald Trump and his relationship with women.
Sure.
and his sensitivity or the lack thereof to these issues around the table and not really arrive at any kind of resolution. But if we assume that some of these programs are going to go away, much more of the burden is going to fall on organizations such as yours.
Right.
How equipped are you to deal with that challenge? I'm going to start with Alan.
Well, I want to say that I want to reject the idea that these programs are going to go away. On Saturday, there were hundreds, thousands, millions of people that came forward and said, we can't allow that to happen. And I think that's right. It doesn't matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or you're an independent. This is about how do we make sure that programs and services and the way that we address societal issues are done effectively. And we know there's a lot of good research done on these programs to show that they're effective, and that housing people, for instance, that are facing domestic violence, either in a transitional housing facility or a shelter, and then into permanent housing, is an effective solution to ending domestic violence. And we have to be able to say, as a country, that we are not going to let these programs erode, and we are not going to let that happen. Because I can tell you right now, none of the providers are ready to pick up the additional need. There isn't a bunch of money that's sitting in a barn somewhere that, waiting for us all to walk up and take to provide these services. It just isn't there.
Jessica.
So, the Institute wouldn't specifically be impacted because that's not where our funding comes from. But I do think that there would be sort of this like groundswell of sort of community concern. And then that would really put our lawmakers to try to figure out where to find county money, city money, or state money, which frankly is just scarce. You know, it's hard right now to decide how to spend state resources. They're trying to build roads. They're trying to build bridges. It's challenging. I think what you would also see right away, too, is an uptick in people going to seek township assistance, which is more flexible but also more limited. So, you know, it's going to be a challenge for the community sort of writ large to figure out how to patch all this stuff together.
Chris.
Yeah, and I want to jump into I personally don't think that I don't think there's many people out there that voted for Trump so that he would cut violence against women funding. I just, in my heart, I believe that people are good and that we want to help each other out. So if you are one of those people, to get involved and to call your senators and representatives and say, no, this isn't what we meant. We wanted you to do other things, but we really think it's important to protect those that are in need and those who are vulnerable and those who are experiencing violence. So that would be what I'd have to say.
And I would say, just to add to that, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is the time, if you feel passionately about any of these issues, this is the time to step up and to get involved, to be involved in an organization that's working towards solutions, to call your elected officials, to tell them how you feel. And, you know, we have to remember that this is how things work. If we want to protect these programs, if we want more assistance, if we need things, we have to be willing to step up and say we need it. It doesn't come from not trying or from not working. It requires each and every person listening to decide, I am going to be part of the solution.
We are talking about domestic violence here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Jane has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jane, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Well, I was wanting to ask about the Child Protective Services agency. I have called many times for my granddaughter, who was psychologically and emotionally being abused by her parents, and nothing was done. And I would like to find out, you know, what can be done. You know, I feel helpless here trying to help my granddaughter. And, you know, for something like that, they don't see it as a concern. And that's my last response I got from them, was there was no concern. So, you know, our children are learning from their parents to be bullies. And it's just a vicious cycle. And nothing's being done about it. And I would like to know, you know, what could I have done better, or, you know, what's in the process right now for Child Protective Services so that they can help her get counseling? And if I may, I want to make a suggestion. I think that they need to start teaching our children in grade schools about mental illness, and they've already gotten a start on bullying, I think, but it's still, there's still a lot more that needs to be done.
Thanks very much for the call, Jane. We'll try to get some answers to your questions, and we obviously wish the very best for you and your granddaughter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Chris, I'll start with you.
First, thanks for calling in. My heart breaks for you. You know, that just sounds like such a painful and difficult situation. If you've involved Department of Child Services and they haven't found cause or been able to prove cause to intervene, then there's several community resources that do family counseling, that do sort of parenting classes or guiding people on how to be nourishing parents or nurturing parents. So I think that would be your best bet. I would say that Indiana does have a good start when it comes to our bullying stuff, because a lot of the curriculum is around respect and caring and that sort of thing, which is the healthy relationship curriculum that we utilize in middle schools and high schools at the Domestic Violence Network when talking about healthy relationships and dating abuse.
Got a couple of questions from a listener named Martha. Said she'd like to know the role of churches in educating people about domestic violence and relationship building. And then the second part is also, does anyone know how the United States compares to other nations in terms of domestic violence? Chris, I think probably
both of those are for me.
Yeah.
First of all, I love when churches contact us. We have done trainings, we've done seminars, we've done day-long events with churches. I think that churches are an underutilized community resource. People who are hurting, people who want to be involved in community, who want to participate, often go to houses of worship of all faiths. So we would love to talk to pastors, to ministers, to worship leaders about ways that they can make their church a welcome environment for those who experience violence through teaching their congregants about domestic violence, having materials available, and having, you know, signage to know that it's a safe place to disclose, that sort of thing. So we would love to talk to you about that. The second piece, I'm not sure if I have off the top of my head comparison notes between other countries. I know that the United States, about 53% of people know someone who's experienced violence, which I think is a low number, and that's from the Avon Foundation as well. So we've got a huge problem here that largely remains in the dark.
We've gotten a comment from via Facebook from a listener named BJ. And again, if you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. BJ writes, I'm a big fan of Thrifty Threads, the shop that supports the Julian Center shelter and provides clothing and household items to help families leaving the shelter. You can declutter and support families affected by domestic violence at the same time. If I may, BJ, I'm going to take the liberty of expanding on that question and say, what are some practical steps, some ways that people can get involved in dealing? I mean, yeah, presumably a large part of this initiative is about generating public awareness and focusing public energy on how we deal with this. What are some ways people can plug in to what you are doing, and how should they go about doing that? I'll start with Jessica first, but I want to hear everyone on that. I suspect the answers can be slightly different from each of you.
Sure. Yeah. So from our perspective, it's, you know, paying attention to what's happening at the state legislature and reaching out to your lawmakers when something is going on that you think is going to impact families. And I think, you know, going back to our very first conversation about how all of these things are intersected, you know, don't discount how much helping families achieve economic self-sufficiency can help with some of these other things as well as providing, to the earlier caller's comment, a safety net for families that might be coming out of affluence but leaving that, you know, leaving their home to go in domestic violence, protecting them from becoming a low-income person. If we had good policies, that wouldn't happen. So that's sort of my thing.
Well, Jessica, and if they want to track what your group considers important to families, how would they go about doing
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Go to www.incap.org/IIWF, sign up for our newsletter. We send out a weekly publication called Inside the State House, and we'll keep you up to date.
Alan.
Well, I think I agree with the comment that Thrifty Threads is a great way to get involved. But there's also, sometimes I think we make it too easy. We want to donate our items to Thrifty Threads and feel good, which is a good thing to do. But also, we all have to be willing to contribute to this cause. So making a direct donation to the Julian Center or the Coburn's place are both great ways to have an impact because they need resources and they're dwindling. But I think like on a personal level, if you think about many children are in the foster care system because they've been removed from violent situations, so you can become a foster parent. It's a great way to have true impact on kids. If you want to volunteer, you can get engaged in the planning efforts and the collective efforts of the continuum of care around homelessness and specifically work in domestic violence area. And there's a lot of ways you can get involved and get involved with by going to the Julian Center or Coburn Place and volunteering directly there.
Chris.
I echo all of that. I think getting involved, calling and writing your senators, those sort of things have a real impact when there's legislation that impacts this issue. I would say also to join our newsletter, go to dvnconnect.org, attend one of our training events, but also in your personal life, teach your kids about healthy relationships, model healthy relationships. And if you see, gender-based inequality or jokes or humor, to correct that.
So let me ask real quickly, if people want to track what you're doing with Intersections, mm-hmm. is there a place they can go to see, the research that you've assembled mm-hmm. and all of that? Can you toss out that URL real quickly, Chris?
Sure. That's dvnconnect.org. And on our website, we have training and events. We have the facts. We have news. We have a great blog archive. We have links to our community partners. We have special sections for the LGBTQ community on resources that are available to them. We have links for the advocates. So there's a wealth of information, and we are still updating it even this afternoon. I'm leaving here to go back and do some more work on it.
Well, I'm going to add to your afternoon's work from the three
fantastic.
Of you if this is possible, because we're still getting comments, mm-hmm. particularly through the Facebook page. I would ask if the three of you would visit our Facebook page and track and maybe respond to some of the questions and comments there so that our listeners can continue the conversation even after we go off the air. A subject this important, I don't think the talk should ever stop. So if you guys would not mind doing
that,
I would be very, very grateful. I'd like to thank our guest today, Chris Hanberg, who is Director of Programs and Research for the Domestic Violence Network, Alan Witchie, who is Executive Director of CHIP, that is the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention of Greater Indianapolis Incorporated, and Jessica Fraser, who is Director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families. Also would like to thank all of our listeners for some great questions and comments and for helping to make this, as always, an enlightening conversation. We will be back on Thursday when we're going to take a dive into the chaotic world of healthcare and healthcare insurance coverage. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cerzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.